Okay, so we're going to begin tonight with the very beginning of the Rambam, as we mentioned. Hilchos Yisod HaTorah, Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph. The Rambam begins, Yisod HaYisodos VeAmud HaChachmos, the pillar of all pillars and, or the principle, the fundamental principle, VeAmud HaChachmos, and the pillar of wisdom, Leida SheYesham Matzui Rishon, to know that there's a first cause. Now, notice how the Rambam uses the term Leida. Why is that significant? Because the Rambam believes, as we mentioned in the previous year, that it's not just a mitzvah of emuna in the sense of blind faith, but it's a mitzvah of yedia, to know. This is something that one must know, one must be confident about, one can prove, as we mentioned last time, and therefore the mitzvah is to know that God exists. Now, he first calls this God as a matsui rishon. In other words, God could be defined in the most basic level, at the most basic level, as the first cause, meaning to say the cause that brought everything else into existence. We exist. What's the cause for our existence? It is God. V'chol ha-nimtzayim mishamayim v'aretz u'ma she'beinehem lo nimtzu elam me'amitas himatzo. And everything else that exists, from heavens to earth, and that which is in between them, only exists because of the truth of his existence. So all other existences depend upon the existence of God. Va'al ya'alel v'im ya'alel adat shehu eino matzoi, ein davar acher yachol lihimatzot. If one were to imagine that he doesn't exist, then nothing else could exist. This is a negative proof, meaning to say, if God doesn't exist, then nothing else could exist, because God is the source for all existence, and we know something does exist, so therefore it must be the case that God exists. Ve'im ya'ale al hadat she'ein kol hanimtzaim milvado mitzuyin, hu levado yihyeh matzui, ve'lo yivatel hu levitulam. And if one were to imagine that all other existences don't exist, he alone would exist. V'lo yivatel hu levitulam, he would not be negated by their negation. Shekol nimtzayim tzrichin lo, v'hu baruch hu eino tzarich lahem v'lo l'achad mehem. Because all other existences need his, or his existence, and he does not need any of them. Lefikach ein amitaso ka'amitas achad mehem. Therefore, his truth is not like their truth. Hu shanavi omer, Hashem Elokim Emet. This is what the prophet means when he says God is true. Hu levado emet, he alone is true. Ve'ein lachad emet kamitato, there is no other truth like his truth. V'hu shatora omeret, ein od milvado, this is what the Torah means when it says there's nothing besides him. Kelomar, ein sham matzui emet milvado kamoto, is no other truth, true existence besides him like him. Now, let's just try to explain what does he mean. What does it mean that other truths are not like his truth? So, it is true that I'm holding a paper. That is true. However, that's what we could call an accidental truth, as opposed to a necessary truth. A necessary truth means a truth which has to be this way. It's inconceivable otherwise. It happens to be that I'm holding a piece of paper now, but it didn't have to be that way. Had I decided 1 minute ago not to hold this paper, then I wouldn't have been holding this paper. In fact, it's not even necessary that I exist. Had my parents never married, I wouldn't have even existed, in which case I certainly wouldn't have held this piece of paper. Had I not printed this paper, I wouldn't have been holding this paper. There are many ways in which it could have been conceivable that I not be holding this paper 1 minute ago. So therefore, it's an accidental truth. It's true, but it just happens to be that way. That is different than the truth of God's existence. The truth of God's existence is a necessary truth. Necessary meaning that it could not have been otherwise. As we mentioned earlier, the Rambam offers proofs for the existence of God. He offers four proofs, and these proofs, he believes, are definitive. God could not not exist. Some people would say, in all conceivable worlds, God exists. What that means is it's a necessary truth. It has to be this way. It couldn't be otherwise. So I exist, but my existence is an accidental existence. It could have been otherwise. God's existence is necessary, and therefore the truth of his existence is truer than the truth of my existence, in the sense that it's a necessary truth as opposed to an accidental truth. Now, the significance of that is exactly what he says here, that Ein emes kamitasam, the truth of God's existence is not like the truth of my existence, and that's what the prophet means when he says God is true. In fact, in Shema every day we say Hashem Elokim emet, and what that means is that the truth of God's existence is absolutely true. It's necessary true. Necessarily true. And that's what it means when the Pasuk in Sefer Devarim says, Ein od milado. There is nothing besides him. What does it mean there's nothing besides him? I don't exist? This table doesn't exist? No. This table can exist and I could exist. What does it mean there's nothing besides him? There's no necessary existence besides his existence, because the table could theoretically not exist. I could theoretically not exist, but he could not theoretically not exist. So my existence and the table's existence depend upon his existence and willing us to exist. And that's what we mean. There's nothing besides him. Meaning to say, there's nothing that necessarily exists. So that is...
I don't fully follow it. If there were no universe, would God have to exist?
Yes, that's what he proves. We could prove... And he doesn't prove it here. He's going to allude to the proof in a moment. But God's existence is necessary, even if there's no universe. In fact, God created the universe, so there's a time that the universe doesn't exist. That statement is itself somewhat imprecise, because the creation of time came about along with the creation of the universe. But for simplicity's purposes, we'll make that statement. There was a point God could destroy the universe and he would continue to exist. God could have decided not to create the universe and he would exist. So God's existence is totally independent of the existence of the universe. The universe happens to exist because God decided to create it, but it doesn't have to exist. God has to exist whether or not. Now, it might be the case that we only know of God's existence because of the universe. If the universe didn't exist, we wouldn't exist, and we wouldn't know of God's existence. We might discover God through examining the universe. That's a cosmological proof. But the proof, since the universe does exist, it means God does exist. And it also means that God exists independent of the universe, because a existence which was dependent upon the universe couldn't be the cause for the creation of the universe.
So the statement of Bishvili Nevarolam?
Bishvili Nevarolam is a different point.
That's
not
right.
That's not
it's
Musar.
No, it's but it's true. A person should have the attitude that the world was created for me. But it doesn't mean to say that I have to exist, and it doesn't even mean to say that the universe or the world had to exist. But my approach should be that God would have created the universe if it was just for me. And that implies a certain degree of responsibility.
So I hear the statement that God has to exist even if he never created the universe.
Mm-hmm.
But is that the proof?
No, the proof
telling
is...
the difference between his existence and our existence.
Correct. The proof is I know the universe exists and therefore God exists. That proof not only proves that God exists, but that proves that God is the cause for the existence of the universe. Or at the very least, the universe could only exist if God exists. Now, I understand what you're saying.
How is that different from you and the piece of paper? In other words, you know, you said that's accidental.
That's accidental. My existence is accidental.
But that piece of paper couldn't have existed if at this time, in this place, unless some human being produced it.
Good.
So
true.
Does that mean that human being is
no, because universal. No, because universal. The human being is also accidental.
When we say incidental instead of accidental,
either one.
It sounds like even for God it was an accident.
Accident doesn't mean we don't mean accident in the colloquial sense.
All
like
right, that's
I
the problem.
Tripped and I had an accident. I fell down and scraped my knee. Accident meaning not necessity. So if incidental is preferable, we could use that word.
Yeah, accident sort of implies that unexpected
okay.
And
that's the term that's used
due to
in
philosophy. Accidentally left my coat home, so I'm
the term accident in philosophy has a different connotation than it does in colloquial speech.
One other thing is the four proofs that he has are here or in
no,
some other sefer.
They're in Chelek Beis Perek Aleph of Mar Nevuchim. Okay, now so that's premise one. Halachos.
Premise one,
halachos aleph through dalet of the Rambam, is that God exists necessarily. Okay, let's move on to halacha. Hey, hamatzui hazeh hu Elohei ha'olam adon kol ha'aretz. This existent, meaning God, is the God of the world, the master of the land. Meaning to say that God does not simply exist, but he relates to the universe. He is Eloha ha'olam. The term Elohim implies power, meaning to say that he relates to the world. One might have said God exists, but he's the God of heavens. He's not the God of earth. He has nothing to do with earth. He doesn't relate to it. The earth is the earth, and God is God. V'lo karv zel zeh. Maybe he created it, maybe he didn't create it. No. Halacha, hey, tells us that not only does God exist, but he is Adon Kol Haaretz. He's the master of the land. V'hu ha-manhig ha-galgal b'koch she'en lo keitz v'tachlit. He causes the rotation of the spheres in a manner which has no end. B'koch she'en lo hafseik, sha'galgal sovev tamid, v'yefshar shisuv b'lo misavev, v'hu baruch hu ha-misavev oso b'lo yad v'lo guf. This, the details of this halacha need not concern us. It relates to the Rambam's conception of the universe, which was a series of concentric spheres constantly rotating, moved by the unmoved mover. But for what's relevant to us is that the universe exists, and there has to be a cause for that existence, and that's God. Now, the truth of the matter is, and I don't want to get into the details here, the Rambam here does not presume that God created the universe. Here, this model works even if the universe existed forever, namely the Aristotelian conception. The Rambam does believe that God created the universe, and not only that, but he thinks that that is the premise upon which all of Torah rests. He writes that is one of the Yud Gimel Ikar Yemuna, in the second edition of the Yud Gimel Ikar Yemuna, and you can find it in the Kapach edition of the Perush Mishnayos. He writes this explicitly in Mor Nevuchim. There's a statement in Mor Nevuchim that confuses people, because he says that I don't believe in the God created the world based on a text, but rather, because a text of the Torah could be interpreted in a different way, rather I believe in it because it's more compelling. But he himself believed in it, and he believed that the entire Torah depends upon it, and perhaps if we have time tonight, I'll elaborate on some of these points. The reason why he doesn't assume it in his proofs is because if you assume God created the universe, then there's no need to prove his existence. So he tries to prove the existence of God even according to those who deny his existence, even those according to assume that matter is infinite. Now, it's still true.
That's the Aristotle group.
Yes. It's still true that even if matter is infinite and the universe always existed, the existence of the universe depends upon God. It's just that God isn't the cause of the existence of the universe. They both happen to always exist. Just God's a necessary existence. The universe is an accidental one. If we have time, I'll elaborate upon all of that at the end. So, premise 2, point 2, is that not only does God exist, but he interacts with the world. Premise 3 is Halacha Zayin. Eloha zeh echad hu ve'eno shnayim ve'lo yaser al shnayim. God is one, not two, or more than two. El echad she'en kichudo echad min achadim hanimtzaim ba'olam. God's oneness is not similar to the oneness of anything else that exists. Lo echad kiminshu kolel achadim harbei, velo echad kiguf echad shu nechlak lemachlakot ulukzavot. Let me explain. When we use the term one and we say God is one, we mean to exclude a numerous things. First of all, we mean to say God is one and not two or not three or not four. There's not two gods. There were those who believed that there were two gods. There was the God of good and the God of evil and Zoroastrianism or the like. No. Rahmana Litzlan, there is one God, not two, or not three, not the Trinity, only one. That's one thing that we mean when we say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. But another thing we mean is that he's one in the sense that he is simple, meaning to say not comprised of parts and not divisible. I'm holding one pencil in my hand, but this pencil is divisible. I could rip it in two. I could make it into multiple things. It is also one pencil among the general species of pencils. There's millions of pencils. This is one of them. So the term one in the case of this pencil means something very different than when I use the term one with respect to God. When I use the term one with respect to God, I mean to say that he is one in the sense that he is simple. He is not comprised of parts. He is not divisible. He's not one of many, but he's one in the sense that he is simple and indivisible. So then he goes ahead and he proves this. He says if there were multiple gods and they were non-physical, then there would be nothing distinguishing between them. And the fact, so therefore you'd be forced to say that God is a physical body, which would mean there's an end to his powers, and that's also inconceivable. And again, perhaps if we have time at the end, we'll read this halacha more carefully. But he concludes with this halacha with V'yedias davar ze mitzvas aseh shenemar Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. So knowing this is a mitzvah aseh, as we say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. So the Rambam here, yes.
The problem is a mitzvah is a command. You must do this.
Good.
And how can you command somebody to know something?
That's an excellent question. And likewise, he said that halachos aleph through dalet are the mitzvah of Anochi Hashem Elokecha, right? The mitzvah of Emuna. So how could that be? So this is a question. This is, in fact, one of the reasons why perhaps the Bahag disagreed with the Rambam and felt that Emuna is not a mitzvah, because how could you command somebody to believe something? Manafshach, if I believe it already, then I need not be commanded. And if I don't believe it, commanding me is certainly not going to convince me. Part of the answer to that question, and we're going to add another dimension later, but part of the answer is that the Rambam felt that there is actually a Maisa Mitzvah here, and that is to attempt to prove it. Meaning to say, it's not just Emuna in the sense of blind faith, like we said, but the very beginning, first line, says the Mitzvah is Leida Sheyesham Matsui Rishon. That this is something that we can prove, and that we must seek to prove. It's insufficient, at least in the ideal sense, to simply believe in God because that's what you've been taught since you were a kid, but somebody should try to strengthen their belief by proving it, by studying philosophy or whatever it is, history. There are many ways that one can strengthen their emunah, and therefore there is a mitzvah, and therefore it does make sense that there be a command. It is interesting, though, that it's not said b'lashon sivoy. It says Anochi Hashem Elokecha. It doesn't say Ta'amin Shani Elokim or Teida Shani Elokim. And that is an excellent point, which I'd like to return to later. It's interesting. The Ramban, yes. Yes and no is the answer. Yes and no. In the Sefer HaMitzvos, he defends the Bahag and explains why Anochi should not be a mitzvah. However, in his own commentary on the Torah, he agrees with the Rambam that Anochi is a mitzvah. So what that means is that the Sefer HaMitzvos is a reflection, is a defense of the Bahag. And therefore he argues for the position that it isn't a mitzvah. But when he presents his own personal position in the commentary on the Torah, then he feels it is a mitzvah. Now I'd like to point out,
We seem to feel or say that Shema Yisrael is the most important thing you can say, and the first thing you teach a child, and you say it twice a day, you say it before you die. But this seems more basic.
Anochi, very good. It's a good question. Why Anochi is basic? Shema Yisrael is Halacha Zayin, right? But it's the third premise. I believe the answer, why do we treat Achdus Hashem as Kabbalas Al Malchus Shemayim? And the answer is as follows. Because belief in God is not enough. It's much more basic. But it's very interesting. Why is it? And why is it that we say Shema means much more than just belief in God being one? For example, the mitzvah of saying Shema is understood by Chazal as referring to Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shemayim, accepting Torah and mitzvos. It's not just the existence of God. It's not even just his oneness. But it's the notion that I have to follow him. You see this, among other things, in the davening on Rosh Hashanah at Musaf. The first section of the Musaf Shmon Esrei, we have Malchios. So there should be 10 psukim about how God is Melech. But what is the 10th pasuk?
Shema Yisrael,
Shema Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Doesn't say anything about Melech. Why is that the pinnacle, the paradigm of Malchus Hashem? And the answer, briefly, is that the oneness of God implies not just that he is one and not two, not just that he's one in the sense that he's simple, but that also relates to us. It is the basis. There is nothing else besides God, and that indicates and implies that he is the king, and we have to serve him, and we have to do his mitzvos. And therefore, that, while based upon Anochi, based upon his existence, is what's most relevant. So we say, even more important than saying Anochi Hashem Elokecha every single day, is to say Shema Yisrael. Shema Yisrael includes Anochi, it includes the existence of God, but goes further in the sense that it implies that he is the Melech, because he's one. There's nothing else that exists, or nothing else that necessarily exists, and that therefore we must follow his Torah and mitzvos. And the point that we're going to make in a moment, I think, will highlight this.
Therefore, when you say Shema Yisrael, your thoughts count because it's not in the words.
Yes.
And maybe Baruch Shem Kvod helps you do that.
Mm-hmm. Good. Excellent point. So these three principles, to summarize what we've seen so far, the three basic principles of Torah are, one, that God exists. Two is that it's not just that he exists, but he relates to the world. It's Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Tzoisicha Meretz Mitzrayim. It's not just that God exists. When he introduces himself, he says, Anochi Hashem, I exist, but also Elokecha, I'm your God, Asher Tzoisicha Meretz Mitzrayim, that interacted with the world that took you out of Egypt. So number one, that he exists. Number two, this was in Halacha Hey, that he interacts with the world. And finally, Halacha Zayin, that there is no other power besides him. He is the sole true power. One of the interesting things, I think, manifestations of this, and it's very, very fascinating, can be found in Parshas Shmos and Va'era, and Bo. I guess Va'era and Bo. What was the purpose, if I were to ask you, what was the purpose of the ten Makos? Why did God bring Makos upon the Egyptians? What do you say?
Well, many people tell you to punish them or to convince Paro to let them go. But obviously we're leading up here that Paro should believe in God.
Okay.
His existence or his
not
power.
Just Paro.
Not only Paro, Bnei Yisrael.
Right.
Yeah, to demonstrate.
Okay. Excellent. So you guys are too smart to ask the question. You outsmarted me. I was hoping I would say, you know, why did God bring the ten plagues? And you would say, so that the Jews could go. And I would say, obviously that isn't true, because on the contrary, God held back the Jews to bring about the plagues. He hardened God Paro's heart, and he said, don't let the Jews go, right? He didn't allow the Jews to go precisely in order to bring about the plague. So it's inconceivable that the purpose of the plagues was to allow the Jewish people to go, when on the contrary, they were held back in order to facilitate the plague. So if so, what's the purpose? So you all jumped the gun, and you said it's to show the existence of God. Now, this is not just a point that could be seen derived intuitively, but it could be seen in the Pesukim itself. And this is a fascinating point. Before each of the, there were three groups of plagues, first three, second three, third three, and then the tenth. Perhaps that's why we say that Tzach Hadash Bachav in the Seder. There are three groups of plagues. And before each of these three groups, Moshe goes to Paro and warns him. And not only that, but he tells them the purpose. He tells Paro and his people the purpose of these plagues. Why am I bringing these plagues upon you? So let's take a look at the purpose that the Psukim say. So this is on page 2, where it says Shmos Perek Zayin, Pasuk Yud Zayin.
This is a very bold statement.
Ah, very good. Ko Amar Hashem, Bezos Teda Ki Ani Hashem. So says God, with this you will know that I exist. So the first purpose of the first three plagues was to prove God's existence, like you pointed out, not just to Paro, but to the whole world. Once in history, God goes ahead and shows the entire world in a clear and conclusive way, that incontrovertible way. Thank you. You figured out what I was trying to think of. Incontrovertible and conclusive way that he exists. And that's, of course, as the Ramban points out, why so many mitzvos are zecher l'yetzias Mitzrayim, because it's not in every generation that God makes miracles. We always go back to that. So the first three plagues was to show that God exists. What about the second three plagues? Skip ahead to Pasuk Yod Ches. V'hiflesi v'yom hahu es eretz goshen asher ami omed aleha levilti hayosham arov. Why? Leman teda ki ani Hashem bekerav haaretz. The purpose of the next three plagues is to show that God is the God of the land. Bekerav haaretz. Not just God in heavens, but God on the land. So that's point two of the Rambam, right? Point one of the Rambam is the purpose, the first three plagues. Point two is Leman teda ki ani Hashem bekerav haaretz. What was point three? So look at Pasuk Yodalin and Perek Tes. Ki b'pam azos ani sholeach es kol magrifosai el libcha v'avadecha v'amecha v'avur teda ki ein kamoni b'chol haaretz. There is no other power besides me. Achdus Hashem, there's only one. And this corresponds to the third principle. So it's not surprising then that the three basic principles are going to be demonstrated in the Makos. These were the purpose, this was the purpose of the Makos. It's very Meduyah. The first group of halachos in the Rambam corresponds to the lesson that God was teaching the world with the Makos. Parenthetically, the tenth plague was a totally different thing. There the Pasuk says, Laman Teidun ki afli Hashem bein Mitzrayim uvein Yisrael. There the purpose was to show the distinction between Mitzrayim and Yisrael. That's why parenthetically the Jews had to do something to deserve it. They had to bring Karban Pesach, Dam Pesach, and Dam Milah. If the purpose was to distinguish them, they had to distinguish themselves. It couldn't just happen on its own. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that around Pesach time. Anyway, this is very, very, very Meduyak according to the Rambam. Now, I'd like to go on and make a couple of, I think, very, very fascinating points. As we mentioned, the Rambam counts Anochi, Emunah, or Yediyah, more precisely, as a mitzvah. And as we mentioned, there are those that disagree, like the Bahag. One of the questions that the Ramban asks on this position is as follows. How did the Rambam know that Anochi is a mitzvah? The Rambam says, I have a proof from the Gemara in Makos. The Gemara is quoted over here. The Gemara says as follows. There are 613 mitzvos. The Pasuk says, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. So, Torah is Gematria 611. 611 mitzvos were taught by Moshe, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. But there were two more that were taught by God. Why is that? Because Anochi and Lohia were mipi ha-gvura shma'um. They were said by God himself. The Jewish people at Sinai heard the first two dibros, as it were, directly from God. And therefore, Torah tziva lanu Moshe, 611 mitzvos were given by Moshe, but two were from God. Now, what do you see from here? You see that Anochi is one of the 613 mitzvos. Otherwise, it wouldn't be included in Taryag, but it is included in Taryag. That's the proof that the Rambam brings in the Sefer HaMitzvos that Anochi is a mitzvah, according to Gemara. Seems like a good proof. The Ramban says that can't be a good proof. Why? How many mitzvos are there in the first two dibros? Not two, but five. Right? According to the Rambam's own calculation. Because
Every time there's a low.
There are five. Right? Lo yiya, lo sasel chapesel, lo sishtachav elohem, lo saavdeim, and anochi. Five mitzvos.
13 mitzvos in this house.
You have to go ahead and figure out.
We shouldn't call them the Ten Commandments.
We shouldn't call them the Commandments. Torah doesn't ever call them the Ten Commandments. Aseres Hadvarim, or we switch it to Dibros, right? Ten utterances.
Utterances, much better.
Okay. Now, even that is somewhat controversial, what exactly the ten are, but that's also for another time. One way or the other, the Ramban says that your proof, Rambam, is lousy. Because if you're going to say the proof is based on the fact that the two first two dibros are mipi agvur shma'um, so then you should count five. It shouldn't say there are 611 mitzvos from Moshe, two from God. It should be there are 608 and five. That's the Rambam's question. So how'd the Rambam let this slip? So to answer this question, the Meshul Chachma points out you have to look at the Mor Nevuchim, which can be found on page 3, section 2, chapter 33. The Meshul Chachma frequently points out, as does his other, the other great Gaon who lived in his city, the Ragachever. They both lived in Dvinsk.
Who was the Meshul Chachma?
The Meshul Chachma was Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk.
Yeah.
And he lived in the same town as the Ragachever. And they both, the Ragachever and Rav Meir Simcha, both felt, they both were Dvinsk. One was the Hasidic leader and one was the Misnagdisha leader. However, they were good friends and they both had a common denominator. That if you want to fully understand the Rambam in Mishneh Torah, or in Sefer Mitzvot, you have to study Mor Nevuchim as well. This is not the standard approach. Standard approach is that it stands as an independent work. One is philosophical,
and
one is...
And not to be bothered with.
I wouldn't go that far, maybe, but... Anyhow, so the Rambam says you want to answer... The Meshul Chachma says you want to see the answer to the Rambam's the question, the Ramban's question, the Rambam, look at the Marnevuchim, he answers it. In Chelek Beis, Perek Lamed Gimel, he writes as follows. I'm going to read it from the Hebrew version, but you could follow along in the English version, which is on the bottom of the page. Yisbarali, Shebimamad Har Sinai, Lo Ayah Megil Lemoshe Megil Lechol Yisrael, Aval Hadibur Lemoshe Levado Alav HaShalom, Vilazeba Sipur Aseres HaDibros, Kulo Sipur HaYachid HaNifrad, Vue Lav HaShalom, Vue Lav HaShalom Yarad, Letachti Sahar, Viaged Levnei Adam, Ma Sheshama. Amra Torah, Anochi Omeid Bein Hashem Uveinechem. Now, Amar Gamkein Moshe Daber VeElohim Ya'anenu Bekol. The Rambam maintains that all of the Jews did not actually hear even the first two commandments. What did the Jews hear at Sinai? They heard the kol, the voice, which was some undifferentiated sound, something which they couldn't make out the exact words of, but was clearly the voice of God. Why couldn't they understand the words? This is because the Rambam writes in Perek Zayin of Hilchos Yesod HaTorah, as well as in the Mora, that prophecy is only conceivable when a person has achieved a very high level of self-perfection. A man or a woman who has perfected themselves, has become extraordinarily knowledgeable and achieved greatness in terms of their midos and the like, can have the possibility of attaining prophecy. That's what the Rambam writes. And therefore, all of the Jewish people couldn't possibly have experienced prophecy. Now, therefore, what did they experience? They all heard the kol, this voice, this sound, which was indeed the sound of God, but they couldn't quite make out the words. If so, then the Rambam continues, V'hu amram anochi v'lo yiyah mepi agvura shema'um. 1 second, doesn't this go against the Gemara in Makos that the Rambam quoted earlier? The Rambam earlier quoted the Gemara in Makos, which said that Anochi and Lohiyah were heard by the entire Jewish people. But according to what he just said, all they heard was the kol. The answer, he says, is as follows. How do we know Anochi and Lohiyah, that's the existence of God? We know that, we could know that through proof, meaning to say we can prove God's existence. And therefore, our knowledge of God's existence is equal to that of a prophet, in the sense that it's direct. It's not something that we heard from somebody else who told us. The rest of the Torah, all other 611 mitzvos, we heard from Moshe, meaning to say Moshe heard them from God, and Moshe transmitted them to us. Whereas the first two mitzvos, which relate to the existence of God, we ourselves heard directly, not in the sense that we heard them from God, but we know them individually, personally, because they could be proven. And therefore, our knowledge is direct. It's not indirect. And that's what it means, mepi agvura shma'um. Now, this idea fully answers the question. When the Rambam says that anochi and lohiyah are mepi agvura, it doesn't mean we literally heard the words, and in which case, then the Ramban's question should be 5 and not 2 would be akasha. It means that we know about it directly and personally. It's not, we don't know of God's existence because Moshe told us God existed, as we know about the mitzvah of tefillin or the mitzvah of tzitzis or the mitzvah of Shabbos. We know of God's existence directly and personally through proof, through the experience of Sinai itself. Now, this idea contradicts at first glance another very important Rambam in Parak Ches of Hilchos Yesod HaTorah, where he says that the basis of our belief in Torah is because we all experience prophecy at Sinai. It's not based on miracles. And perhaps another night we could explain this contradiction. If you understand the two Rambams, they don't contradict, but at first glance they do and seem to be problematic. However, what I really would like to do with you for the rest of tonight is compare the approach of the Rambam to another approach of Emunah, a totally different approach, and that is the approach of the Kuzari. And this approach was indeed the preferred approach by the Rav, among others. As we'll see, he frequently refers to the ideas in the Kuzari, though not necessarily by name, but in his presentation. And we're going to introduce this position with a medrash. The medrash is found, the citation is on the bottom of page 5. The medrash itself is quoted on the top of page 6. And the medrash says as follows. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Mashal echad shaya over mimakom lemakom v'rabira achas dolakas. Amar, Tomer habira zu below manhig, hititzalav bal habira, Amar lo, anihu bal habira. Kach lefi shehaya avinu Avraham omer, Tomar sha'olam hazeb li manhig. How is it that God, that Avram came to discover God? We know that Avram independently discovered God. He lived in a world of idolatry. According to the Rambam, he himself served idolatry in his youth. So how was it that he came to an appreciation of God? He asked a very simple question. How could there be a universe without God? There must be some cause. There must be some creator. And that's how he came to be aware of the existence of God. However, the Medrash doesn't stop there. The Medrash continues, Heitzitzalav HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'Armelo Anihu Baal HaOlam. After Avram discovered the existence of God, God spoke to Avram and said, yes, it's me. You figured out I created the world. After all, there must be some creator. You know who it is? It's me. And that's prophecy.
And that's what?
That is prophecy. God doesn't just leave him at the philosophical conclusion, but he relates to him. He speaks to him. With this, we'll turn to the Kuzari.
So, did you say the Mashal is copied, printed here?
The Kuzari?
No, the Mashal about the Bira.
This is the Medrash.
Oh, okay.
That's up here, okay. Top of the page.
And where is that from?
That is, as you see, the citation is the bottom of page 5, Bereishis Rabba Parshas Lech Lecha, okay. Parsha Lamites Os Aleph. Okay. Now, says the Kuzari, Ve'en shem miduyak yoser min hashem hanechtav bi'osios yud kei vav kei yisborach v'yisromam zeu shem prati bo romzim le'eloha lo b'toar amakom kederach haromzim l'chol mitoar mituar bilti yadua ve'lo b'tarim nosafim al atzmuto. Okay. What the Kuzari here says is that there's a difference between the Shem Havaya, Yud Kei Vav Kei, and all other names of God. All other names of God reflect the way in which he acts or relates to the world. Elohim is Din, for example. They're also frequently generic terms in the sense that Elohim could be used as reference to a judge, Elohim Achirim and the like. Whereas the Shem Havaya is his personal name. It's like, my name is Netanel. So that Kaviyachol is God's name. It's a Shem Prati. It's, as opposed to other names which are predicates and attributive descriptions, this is his personal name. Exactly. And then he continues, and we'll skip to the next paragraph since it's late. Amar Kuzari, hinenit ba'er li hafresh ben hashemot Elohim v'Hashem. Now you've explained the difference between the name of God Elohim versus the name of God of Hashem. V'havinosi ma rav hamerchak ben Elokei Avraham uvein Elokei Aristo. Now I understand the great difference between the God of Abraham and the God of Aristotle. Ki l'Hashem yit'ale mishtokikim b'nei adam shehisiguhu b'chush. Val yisod edut raya, ve'ilu le'lohim notim al pi hekish hegyoni. What is the God of Aristotle? It's Elohim. Aristotle went ahead and, from a philosophical perspective, proved the existence of God. But it's not a personal God. It's not Shem Havaya. It's not something that we can relate to. It's not something that we could have a relationship to. It's just God.
A force.
It's an existent. It's the first cause. But it is not something which we could possibly have any connection to. So that is the God of Aristotle. The God of Avram is the Shem Havaya. It's something that you could relate to with a name. It is a personal God. And he continues. V'ilu le'elokim, mishe sigu b'chush, bali de mesiros nefesh, mitoch avas eloka, v'lidei nechones lamus aleha. When it comes to a personal God, the God of Avraham, so that's something that a person could be moser nefesh for. Nobody would be moser nefesh for this philosophical God, the God of Aristotle. L'mashal mahadavar domem. I am 100% convinced that there are 180 degrees in a triangle. Let's say a new president is elected, or an old president, President Obama decides that he's going to make a new law, that you have to believe that a triangle has 181 degrees. And not only that, somehow he convinces Congress to pass this law. And not only that, but the Congress says that anyone who does not accept this will be punished by death. So even though I'm 100% sure that a triangle only has 180 degrees, it's not something I'm going to give my life for. Okay, so I'll say it has 181 degrees. Nishta ze geferlach. What difference does it make? Even if I think it's wrong, I'm not going to be moser nefesh. If all God is this proof, so then it's not something that you'll ever be moser nefesh for. It's a proof. It's a philosophical construct. Even if you know it's true. That is why, by the way, Avram Avinu, who discovered God, and then God spoke to him, and he went beyond the God of Aristotle, but became the God of Avram, had to have these nisyonos, and had to be moser nefesh. Avram's mesiris nefesh for God was a reflection of this connection. The Sefer Akedas Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Arama, writes, one of the late Rishonim, that that's one of the purposes of Akedas Yitzchak, because a philosopher would never be willing to do this. From the perspective of a philosopher, this is the height of stupidity to kill your own son because God spoke to you. But because it was Elohei Avraham, God, Avraham was willing to do it. Oh. You know, it's like the difference is that a person, we could debate endlessly whether a metal box is capable of flying. You say, yes, I say no, back and forth. But when you see a 747 take off, so there's nothing left to talk about. We see it, right? The debate, exactly. So when God spoke to Avraham, everything changed. And at that point, just to skip to the end of this passage from the Kuzari, since it's late, which is on the bottom of page 7, that v'itachin ki ha'iyun hazeh shematzanu b'sefer yitira ha'iyuno shel Avram Avinu sha shekvar nizbaru lo achdos halokah v'ribonos v'ribonoso ach terem zachal izgalos ulam la'achar shezachal izgalos azav es kol ha'akashim v'lo bikesh me'im ha'alokah ki im lihios lo liratzon acharei asher lamdu ha'alokah mahu ratzon b'mei usagu v'ezim akom. Once you know God exists, once God speaks to you, so all of these philosophical proofs, they're worthless. The Rav frequently quotes from Søren Kierkegaard, who is a Danish theologian, Christian theologian and philosopher, and expresses this idea of the Kuzari in a very powerful way. He writes, this is a quote from Lonely Man of Faith, page 52 on page 8. Does the loving bride in the embrace of her beloved ask for proof that he is alive and real? Must the prayerful soul clinging in passionate love and ecstasy to her beloved demonstrate that he exists? In other words, we are davening. We're being hugged by God. We're in a passionate embrace. If someone is hugging their lover, they're in a passionate embrace with their spouse, they don't think, oh, can you prove your existence? Right? That's ridiculous. So Kierkegaard made fun of Anselm of Canterbury. Anselm of Canterbury prayed for days and days that he be shown a complex ontological proof for the existence of God. Ontological proofs are very complex. The Jews never really bought into them. But what they are is a separate point. He said, it's ridiculous. You're praying for an ontological proof? You're in love with God. You don't start thinking, oh, does he exist? I need some proof. That doesn't make any sense. When you have Elokei Avraham, when you have that personal interaction with God, there's no need for proofs anymore. They fall away. They're pointless. The Rav in The Lonely Man of Faith says this is the difference between Adam 1 and Adam 2. He writes that Adam 1, which is reflected by Adam, is created as presented in the first chapter of Bereshis. So Adam 1 relates to the cosmic God. That's why it's Bereshis bara Elokim. Remember, Elokim, according to the Kuzari, is a reflection of this philosophical construct. Adam 1 relates to God as the philosophical construct. He looks at the universe and he concludes that God exists. But Adam 2 is the person who relates to God in a personal way. And thus, in Bereshit chapter 2, which describes Adam 2, it's Hashem. It's not. It's Hashem Havaya. It's no longer just Elohim. While Adam 1 maintains some distance from God, relating merely to the divine endowment of creativity, Adam 2 has a genuine living experience of God and is preoccupied with him, as evidenced by the metaphor of God breathing life into his nostrils. It's that close interaction. Adam 2 is created by the breath of God, by this intimacy, and therefore there's no reason for proof. Now, if we had time, we would elaborate upon this. But this is something that the Rav felt was very important in the modern time, because many people feel in the post-Kantian world that these types of proofs that the medieval philosophers offered were no longer relevant. I don't think this is necessarily true, but this is what the Rav felt. And therefore, we relate to God now through the experiential component, the component described by the Kuzari, Elokei Avraham, and not just Elokei Aristotle. So, sorry, we have to end. Have a wonderful week, and God willing, we'll pick up next week, and thank you so very much.
Thank you.
If you want to talk after Mariv, we can.
That'd be good.